addict named Jeff. Good morning. It's truly my honor and pleasure to introduce Casey. Casey is a core member of our home group. She's been of service. A friend of ours who likes to say this, I ain't going to name him, but Will always says, if anything's worth doing, it's worth overdoing. And that's Casey. That's Casey to a T. She puts her whole heart and soul in anything she does. And she doesn't take any type of service commitment lightly. And she's got a spirit about her, and it's bright. And it comes through, you know, and shines for a lot of people. She's been helped on the way by many people sitting in this room, and especially from her old home group, and I got to put a plug in, from Elk City, Oklahoma, out west. So. Mm-hmm. And her and I met at a fundraiser for Norman Winter Convention in 2015. It escalated and took off from there. We got married in 2017. And it's so nice to have somebody in your life who's reading out of the same book and on the same page a lot of times as you are. And if we stray and squabble about things, we always seem to work it out. And I learned not to trade licks with her because she hits harder. And she's got a wonderful story. I'm truly honored for her to be my wife, my partner, my caretaker, my supporter, and y'all to see her when she's my cheerleader. That's good. And without further ado, Casey L.
Prepared here. Good morning, family.
Good morning.
My name's Casey and I'm an addict.
Hey, Casey.
And just grateful to be here. I'm really, truly grateful for the committee for asking me to share. It's a true honor to be the Sunday morning spiritual speaker. When I was preparing to speak last week, I was just sitting there and I remember thinking, like, I'm not feeling very spiritual right now. Does anyone have any adult children living in their home? Anyone? Need I say no more? So, man, do you remember what it was like when you came in and you're like staying clean just for today, you know, and then that was too hard, you were staying clean hour by hour, and when that was too hard, it was minute by minute. And that's how it's been for me not to react at home, you know, minute by minute, not to react. And so today I have 7 days. But I was like, man, I need to read something about spirituality. You know, it's a spiritual meeting. And so I got the Living Clean book, and there's a lot of stuff in there. Spiritual path, spiritual journey, spirituality is practical, versus spiritual, not religious program and everything. And I'm reading and reading and reading. And after I got done reading, I was like, I got nothing. You know, I really wanted to have like a sentence, you know, for y'all to just bam it, you know, and give y'all something good. But I just sat there and thought, and I can't think of anything more spiritual than my experience, strength, and hope. And so today I'm just going to share my story. I'm going to talk about the steps. I'm going to talk about freedom, and I'm going to talk about purpose. And I'm really feeling a little overwhelmed because the speakers Friday and Saturday night really kicked it out of the park, didn't they? They were awesome! Man, the committee did so good. You guys did so good. That was very heartwarming. I could really relate to the Friday night speaker because I also wanted to be a Ninja Turtle. So I looked at my husband and I was like, I wanted to be a Ninja Turtle. He was like, I know. But man, as a young kid, I knew I was different because that kid told me I was. The kid came up to me and he said, "Hey, did you know that you have one eye smaller than the other?" And I was like, "No." I mean, I didn't know. I didn't know that till he pointed it out. And I started looking in the mirror and I started noticing it. Then when there was like school pictures and pictures, that's when the obsession started. And I recognized that I was different and that I felt like something was wrong with me. And so things were just pretty distorted. As I grew up, as an adolescent, I knew two feelings, aggression and depression. And so we know what that leads to, like homicidal, suicidal. But what it did, it landed me into behavioral health units. And I spent from the age of 12 to 15 in hospitals, in and out of hospitals. And at age 15, I overdosed. And they told me, "Well, we think we know what's wrong with you. You're an addict. You got substance, abuse problems." And they sent me to my first treatment center over in Enid. And it was kind of a half treatment center, half mental health. And that's where I was introduced to the 12 steps. Thank you, H and I, everybody. So even though I didn't get the message then, it planted a seed and I knew where to go later. I didn't believe I was an addict. I didn't think I had a problem. If I wanted to quit, I could, but I didn't want to, But like I said, it planted a seed. When I got out of treatment, I just continued on using and ended up getting married, having a baby. And eventually my parents stepped in and my family and did an intervention and they took my kid. And that was the first time I realized I was an addict. I wanted to quit using and I couldn't. I loved my baby so much, but I could not stop using. When I was I was 21 years old, after I lost my son, things just progressed further. And with all the guilt and the shame, I just continued to use. I was living with a drug dealer. I was broken, I was beaten, and I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I left him, took off walking. I had enough money in my pocket, and I never had money in my pocket. And I walked down to this little Roach Motel, and I had enough money. Enough money for a few nights in a hotel room. And I had nothing but the clothes on my back, and there was nothing in that motel room but a book in the end table. And I opened that book and I started reading it and I started praying and I found my higher power through the pages of that book. And I just sat there and I showered, I wrapped the blanket around me and I slept and I cried and I prayed and I sat there and I said, "God, I don't know what I'm gonna do. I don't know where I'm gonna go. I don't know what I'm gonna do." And I heard this voice that said, "Call your mom." And I sort of said, "God, I don't know what I'm gonna do." and I heard, "Call your mom. She's the only one that's gonna help you." And I thought, "God, I'll do anything but call my mom." I had a lot of resentments against my mother and a lot of anger because she took my son from me. And I blamed her for how far my addiction took me because of the guilt and the shame and how much I used. And so it was really hard for me to pick up that phone. But I picked up the phone and I called her and I said, "Mom, I am ready to go to treatment. I'm tired of this. I'm ready." And she said, "I'm sorry, Casey, but I can't help you." And I remember crying out, and I was like, "Why did you tell me to call her?" I was so angry. And I went to sleep, and the next morning, I heard on the room, and I opened it. It was my mom. She came for me. And I went home with her, and I got into treatment. And the only thing I really remember about treatment was that I was talking about God a lot, and I was getting on everybody's nerves. And I was pregnant. I found out I was pregnant with twins. So that was really cool. It was scary, but it was cool. When I got out of treatment, I went to, they told me to go to a meeting. So I went to Elk City NA, and that was my home group. And David was there, and they welcomed me. went around and had a newcomers meeting, and David said, well, I didn't have a beer in kindergarten, but I sure could have used one. And I could relate to that. You know, and I was talking about God, and I was getting on everybody's nerves. And David lined me out. He said, this is a spiritual, not religious program. And he also taught me about identification as an addict. There's not two diseases, there's one disease. Alcohol is a drug, Casey. And so, of course, I did what I did. I was very rebellious and defiant, and I still introduced myself with two diseases. Just to show him that I could do what I wanted, nobody was going to tell me what to do. Just because we have spiritual experience doesn't mean we're spiritual. It took me a while, and then I started following suit. And so he taught me a lot about love and tolerance, too, you know, because he loved me. He tolerated me. He welcomed me. They say if NA is a program of compliance, many of us would have walked away or been asked to leave. And they didn't do that. They just kind of looked at me. Sometimes people would shake their head, you know. But eventually I just started announcing myself that I was an addict. After a couple of years of being clean, I just had a desire to provide for my family. I wanted to get off welfare. I wanted to do something good. My sister encouraged me to go to college. She said she'd go with me, and we did it together. It was very hard for me because I never really went to school. And they did the testing on me and said I had to go to basic level courses and zero level credits. And so I did that. I was in a basic math class, and my instructor told me, said, you're not going to pass basic math. And I remember being so upset. Like, if I can't pass basic math, I'm not going to be able to do anything. And I did all the tutoring and stuff. And I said, and I told him, I said, well, how many classes do you teach? And he said, I've got two classes. I said, can I sit in your other class? He said, oh, sure. And I said, are there any other math teachers here? He said, there's a lady that teaches two math classes. And I went up to her and I said, can I sit in your math class? And she was like, what? You know, she thought that was real weird. Anyways, I could respond to her teaching a little bit better. And so I sat in four classes at the college, and I ended up passing basic math that semester. So, and I needed college algebra to get my degree, so I went on to intermediate, and then I had to take college. So, you know, I was just really determined to do something with my life. And I couldn't have done it without my sister. She was really my encourager. So then I got my degree in applied science and became a nurse, and immediately went into work for the ICU. Life sort of started happening. I had my husband, I had my twins, I had the kid that I had lost, and my family was together, and we were attending church and doing all the things, and I was just so busy with work and kids and all the things. I stopped going to meetings. And I don't know how long I was out of there, but it was a while. And what happened was life happened. And I remember the pain was just so unbearable. I just wanted to change the way I felt. And the disease started talking to me. And the first thing that came to mind was like, well, you know, God did turn water into wine. You know, surely that's okay. And then I thought, you know what, actually, when I was using, I didn't even have God in my life. That was probably what the problem was. You know, now that I have God, I can control and manage this. You know, and I had, well, the denial was so thick, I actually believed that God was going to help me control and manage my using. And I just wanted a few moments of relief, and I picked up. And anyways, after I picked up, I just kept picking up, and I ended up, it wasn't too long, maybe a matter of a few months. I didn't stretch it out as long as a lot of people do. I lost my job, my career. I lost my husband. I left my husband, actually. I left my husband. I left my children. I left my home. And I was back on the streets. I was back in those motel rooms doing what we do. And I stayed out about a year until I got sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I was beaten again and broken. And reached out to a friend in the program. They led me to a physician that got me into treatment again. And so I went to treatment, and the only thing that got me to treatment was that little bag of dope, and it was in my pocket, and it was like my whoopee, and I carried it, and it got me all the way to the treatment center door. And I remember going in, and that doctor was pissed. He was so mad because I was so high, and he said, do you even want to stop using? And I said, no. And he said, then why are you here? And I said, because I don't want to stop using. And he was sort of like, you know, something's wrong with me. I need help. You guys are the professionals. And he said, okay, come on in. And when I got there, they put me under a lot of psychological testing. Has anybody done that? Anyone? Two people? Okay. It was like 4 hours of all these questions. And so I got my results. And I was telling them, I said, so what's the results? You know? And they said, well, you're paranoid. And I said, you put me under 4 hours of testing to tell you? I could have told you that. My roommates could have told you that. Everybody here knows that. You know? And of course, they had a long list of things. And I was like, great, you know, here I am going into treatment with one diagnosis, coming out with 10. Wonderful. When I completed, that was a 90-day program. I went to, they sent me to Austin, Texas, to a recovery home because of one of my other things, codependency. They thought I would get back into a toxic relationship in Oklahoma and that I would be right back using. And so I went to Austin, Texas. Looked for a job. I could not, nobody would hire me. I was kind of a weirdo. I mean, I was the person that was talking to yourself, you know, and somebody came up to me and said, did you know that you were talking to yourself? And I was like, no, I didn't know. Why didn't anybody tell me? You know, and I started recognizing, but nobody wanted to hire me. And so we're pretty innovative when we get clean. We know how to take care of ourselves. I grabbed the mower from the recovery house and went and basically begged and went around from house to house asking if I could mow your lawn for a donation. And that's how I paid my rent. After some time and I got healed up, I eventually got a job at a nonprofit facility and I was so excited that they hired me. Eventually I got, sorry, I'm so nervous up here. Thank you.
You're my sponsor.
When I got out, thank you. I finally got approved to go back to work, but Texas would not license me because I needed a monitoring program. I could not get in the Texas monitoring program because I had to have a Texas license. And so the board and whatnot said, we'll send you back to Oklahoma. And I came back to Oklahoma to a recovery house. And I was really, really excited about that because all my kids were in Oklahoma. And I got to get them on the weekends and bring them into the house with me and see them every weekend. I ended up moving back to Elk City and I got my job back and started working as a nurse again. And I racked up about 5 years clean. And the only thing I remember about that 5 years really was I was working all the time, I was making meetings, I was running a recovery home for women, and I was dating a drug dealer. You know? So anyways, I was able to stretch out some clean time, but it finally got me in at 5 years I used. When I I stayed out about 6 weeks and went to treatment for a 30-day treatment center, and I went into that treatment center, and they said they put me under the psychological testing again, and I was like, y'all don't have to do that. I already know I'm paranoid, I can tell you. And she said, my counselor came out, and she said, man, I'm really concerned. She said, number one, she told me a few things, but what stuck out and what really hurt was she said, you don't learn from your mistakes. This says you do not learn from your mistakes. And we've heard that in sanity, doing the same things over, expecting different results. And she said, and another thing, your IQ is really low. And for you to have a degree and be a professional, that's concerning. And she said, I tell you this because I just want you to know the damage that you've done to your brain. And at that point, I just accepted that I may never be a nurse again. When I got, the other thing that she gave me was an assignment was she gave me a snake and she said, take this snake and cut the head off. Don't bring it back until you know what that means. And I didn't know what that means. And I kept it every day. I carried it wherever I went. And I finally realized I knew what it means. I needed to cut the head off completely. I need to surrender. It's the toxic relationship. It's the boyfriend. And so I took it back to her and I told her I know what it is. It's people, places, and things. It's first step stuff. And when I got out of treatment, I went back to Elk City, and they said, make a meeting. The day you get out of treatment, make a meeting. And I remember being in my apartment, and I was pacing back and forth. I was so nervous. I didn't want to go back. I felt like people were talking about me. I felt like they were judging me, and I didn't know how I was going to face everybody because of my relapse. And I pushed through. I went back to my home group, and I showed up just in time for the meeting because I didn't really want to talk to anybody. I was embarrassed. I was humiliated. I was in a lot of self-pity. Everybody went around and shared, and the meeting went about just like a normal meeting. And at the end, somebody said, does anybody have any inane and related announcements? And the guy said, yeah, Casey's back. And everybody started clapping, and they all were looking at me. They were welcoming me. They were so happy that I was alive and that I made it back. And they had a big card there, and everybody had signed things telling me how grateful they were for me and that I made it back and that I was alive. And I didn't even know they knew I was getting out of treatment. I had no clue they knew I was getting out. And so I'm so glad that I pushed through that. You know, they loved me back. They didn't judge me back. So I decided to get a sponsor and start working some steps. I needed to do something besides, you know, meeting makers make it and don't use no matter what. I remember being so miserable that I thought, man, if I'm this miserable clean, I could be miserable using. And that's sort of the pain that motivated me to start putting the pencils to the steps paper. And I got with Melissa, my sponsor, and we started working some steps. And man, Melissa helped me a lot. She's the one I told all my secrets to first. And she helped me with my assets when we get to that spot in the fourth step. And I said, what are some assets? And I remember I just started bawling and crying because I couldn't think of one good thing about myself. She helped me with that because that's how much self-pity I was in. I was also a very angry person. And so when I began to write on my resentments, about 3/4 of those resentments left me just looking at my part in things. You know, I never knew I had a part in anything. And once I seen the part that I played, it just left me. You know, most of it had to do with my using. And, you know, one of the big resentments I had was against my dad because he bought my sister a car when she graduated and he didn't buy me one. And when I looked at my part, I thought I wouldn't have bought me one. So it's funny, you know, I went through so much. I had a lot of bad things happen to me, but that was the one thing that was affecting me was that after all we've been, you know, we've all been through trauma and horrible things, but that was the one thing that was getting me. And it left after looking at my part. So I got freed up. Six and seven for me was when I stopped taking everyone else's inventory and realizing that I had issues. I remember after some clean time, somebody harmed me. And I called my sponsor and I said, you know, this is what's happened. I don't want to use, but I want to do this, 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 and this. And she said something about like dignity and grace or something. You got to keep your own dignity. You got to keep your side of the street clean. And that was sort of a new concept. I always thought somebody harmed me, I got to harm them back. You know, if you harm me, I harm you back. I one up you. I let you know that you can't hurt me. And, you know, if you slept around on me with one person, I'd sleep with 10. And she said, what happened then? Well, I got an STD. So then it was like the light switch flipped, and I realized that, you know, every time I tried to punish somebody, I was just harming myself. And I looked back in all my life, and every time I retaliated or every time I paid somebody back, I'm the one that got hurt. And so that was sort of a turning point for me and a change in my life. She told me, you do not have to absorb someone else's crazy, you know. And she'd always say these little few things, you know. She was a woman of few words, but she always said something that helped me. I used to take things to her, and I'm like, this person's doing this and this. And she said, well, we're not a bunch of balls of mental health bouncing around in A. And isn't it funny how our sponsor tells us something and we hear something else? She said, Casey, she's heard me share about that. She said, Casey, I did not say that. She said, I said we're not a bed of mental health. And I'm like, well, that's not how I heard it. And I'm going to continue to say it this way. I was a kind of a bouncy little thing, so maybe that's why. But I tell that to my sponsees, too, when they bring me things. And it kind of releases us from having expectations of each other, you know. I was going to tell you, I had sponsees do that to me. They were gone in the meeting, and she said, Casey said I could sleep with whoever I wanted. Even if they came, even if they were in the meetings. And I was like, I never said that, you know. What I said was, you can do anything you want to, as long as you're willing to pay the consequences. Telling people, I said, you can sleep with whoever you wanted. And I actually had two sponsees that said that. I'm like, y'all are giving me a bad reputation. So, when I was driving down the road, you know, my defects and principles and this program, everything was real mechanical for me. I remember driving down the road and I was looking through, scrolling through social media, and I saw my son, my oldest son, and I had actually given up guardianship to him, to another family. And I saw him on there with his new family, and he had they all had matching shirts, and they looked like this beautiful family. And I remember feeling uncomfortable, and it was around Christmas time. And I had planned on giving all my kids the same amount of money. And I remember thinking, well, I'm not giving him anything. You know, I was upset. I was like, he has everything he wants. His family's wealthy, and he doesn't really even need it. You know, and I thought, Casey, what's happening? You know, what are you feeling? What's happening right now? And I was like, this is jealousy, you know, of my own kid, and low self-worth and guilt and shame. And so I was like, what do I do? And I got my phone, and I scrolled through, you know, the defects and the principles, and I found jealousy. And it said, be happy for others, you know, and it said gratitude. And so I began to pray, and I started saying, God, thank you so much. Thank you so much for providing for my son. Thank you for giving him a family. Thank you for taking care of him. And I started getting grounded in gratitude. I'm so grateful for what I am, what I have, and who I am. And that and it just left me. And I was able to give him, everybody, their money. And it felt good. And so I felt good about doing the right thing. Another thing in recovery that I was struggling with was I was struggling with sharing. If you can't notice up here, I'm sort of like all over the place and a little choppy. I'm very nervous. But I was struggling with sharing in meetings. People were asking me to come share at their home group and to tell my story. And I would say, I can't, I have to work. And make excuses. And my friend told me, you know why you're not sharing at meetings? You know why you're saying no? And I said, because I have anxiety. She said, no, you're stingy. She said, you're stingy. You're being stingy with recovery. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I don't want to be stingy with the program that saved my life. I don't want to be stingy with the program that gave me a life. I'm not going to be stingy with this. You know, next time somebody asks me, I'm going to say yes. Well, of course, somebody asked me again. We were at an event, and it was a home group share, and somebody had fallen out, couldn't do it, and he came up to me and said, you're from Elk City. You know, do you think you can share your experience, strength, and hope? And I was like, no, I can't. Sorry. So this is where I tell you about the girl who gave me courage. Oh my gosh, I don't know who she is. I don't know what her name was, but since I didn't do it, they went and asked somebody else. And she got up there, and she said, my name is so-and-so, and she sat there, and she just started crying, and she ran out. And I remember thinking, she had more courage than you did, Casey. You know, and I thought, if she can do it, I can do it too. And the next time somebody asks me, I'm going to do it. Well, they asked me to share at the women's meeting, and this time I said yes, and I went, and I shared my experience, strength, and hope. I got up there, and I said, my name's Casey. I found a new way to live. And their faces were like this. And they were just staring at me. It looked like tornado went in there. They were just in awe. And I think I shared like 12 minutes. And somebody came up to me and said, hey man, this is a spiritual, not religious program. You can't be speaking in tongues in here. And my friend came up to me. She's like, Casey, that was so bad. Oh my gosh, that was horrible. And, you know, I'm really glad she said that. You know, those honest friends, you got to love them. Another girl came up to me and she said, you know, you really gave me some hope. You know, and I really felt like I couldn't go back to school because of all my drug use. And you've given me the encouragement I needed to go back to school. And that's where it hit me. You know, you don't have to be good at something to carry a message of hope to somebody. When I went to Breakfast Club, I shared my story and I was able to share a little bit better. And somebody came up to me and said, will you be my sponsor? You start sharing, you get sponsees. And another girl, she said, I want you to be my sponsor because you've relapsed a lot and I don't want to. So our real values in being ourselves, you know. And another girl came up to me and said, you know, I never really even liked you. I didn't even think you were an addict. You know, and so, but she related to me and I related to her. And so I found connection in sharing. And I realized that you can be, isolation just isn't about staying at home. It's also about not being vulnerable and not letting people in. We can be isolated that way too. And so I found connection. And man, speaking of sponsees, when I started sponsoring, I started appreciating my sponsor. It's kind of like that parenting thing. You hate your parents. You don't like your parents. Not that I ever hated you. But you don't appreciate them until you become a parent. And so I was like texting her, I love and appreciate you. And she was like, thank you. You know, I'm sure she was like, you never did before. What's new? You know, but it's because I started sponsoring and I really had a lot of appreciation for my sponsor. I'm kind of a laid-back sponsor, it works if you work it, and I don't really give a lot of assignments, just a few suggestions, you know, read the literature, go to meetings, you can call me if you want to, you don't have to, type of sponsor, just very laid-back, but there are some things I'm strict about. I remember telling a sponsee, hey, your clean date is the last time you used, you know, because you had a clean date for this and this and this, and I said, it's the last time you used any mood and mind-altering chemicals. And so then she fired me. But, you know, that's kind of my drumbeat, you know. And through my relapses and through my research, I've realized that, you know, whatever message I carry to you is the same message I carry to myself. And if I carry a message of hope to you, I carry that same message of hope to myself. If I tell you it's okay to use, I tell myself it's okay to use, you know. And, so if you come to me with this diagnosis or that diagnosis saying I have to be on this or this or this for that, and I'm not talking about mental health meds or anything like that, I'm talking about mood and mind altering chemicals, I'm going to tell you that you're not an exception to hope. And had somebody say, hey man, you know, it's dangerous to tell people to get off their meds. I'm not telling anybody to get off their meds. I'm telling you, you're not an exception to hope. You know, our message is one of hope, and it says that any addict, it doesn't say any addict unless you have PTSD, ADD, ADHD, bipolar, BPD, chronic pain. Remember that? Remember I went in with one diagnosis and I came out with 10? It says any addict can stop using, lose the desire and find a new way to live.
Right.
At this point, I got released to go back to work. Am I doing on time? I got released to go back to work, and remember, I never thought I was going to be a nurse again. But nobody would hire me. I kept going on interviews, and nobody wanted to hire somebody that could not pass narcotics, that they had to supervise. You can only work certain hours, and it was so depressing, and I was so down and out, and I was broke. One of the, they had all these requirements, all these drug tests, all these things I had to do that cost money. They wanted me to go to this support group that was going to be expensive, and it was 45 minutes down. It was going to take time out of my day, away from my family, money out of my pocket. And I was sitting there thinking, I found a loophole. And if you lived 50 miles away, then you didn't have to go. And I remember thinking, my sister lives 15 minutes that way. I will just change my address. You know, we're good. We're good. And I just thought about all the lies that I could do and how I could rearrange everything. And I finally just thought about the principles of our program, and I thought, Casey, just do the right thing. Just be honest and trust God to take care of things. Just step back. And so I did, and God worked things out financially, and He worked it out for me to go to that support group. And what happened is there was a lady there that took a liking to me. She was like, have you tried this hospital? And I was like, they don't hire nurses being monitored. They've already said that. And she said, well, she talked to somebody. She had a son that worked there. And he gave my name to him, and she said, put your application in. And I did, and I did the interview, and then it went horrible, and I wouldn't hire me, and they hired me. And so I got the job. I got a few minutes to, it's so hard, I've never talked in the morning, so I'm kind of like, y'all are like, and I'm like, and I'm usually more exciting than this, but you know. So as far as my amends, I'm really grateful that I had my sponsor's guidance through this process. You know, she told me there was one amends. She said, Casey, you know, you were a kid in that situation. There were adults in that situation. You don't need to make amends for that. And I got to release a lot of guilt and shame, that unnecessary guilt and shame that I was carrying for that. Also, my mom, I really harmed her, and so I had this idea that I was going to give her so much money every week and make up for it. You know, I was going to pay for the wrong I did. And she was like, okay, hold up. You know, I don't want you to do anything that you're not going to be able to follow through with. Also, you have a husband. Should you talk to him about your finances? And so I just prayed about it. I just started to pray about what I should do, and God opened a door. I'm really glad for the speaker. I think it was Dalton that shared about this being a spiritual step, and that God is going to open those doors, so we don't have to do it right away. We just pray about it, and He'll open the door. My mom, there was work that she needed to do, and so me and my family went and painted her house. We did the eaves. She ended up having a stroke, and so my brother and my sister and I, we split her bills, and we paid her house taxes, and we showed up for her. And every time something happens or she needs something, maybe even it's a book from Amazon or whatever, I just get it for her. And so it's a living amends forever to my mother, you know. What was really cool about it too, as I was praying, I got a card in the mail, and it was, my mom gave me a card. And you guys can't appreciate this like I can, because she doesn't send mail. She can't even find the post office. I mean, and we opened it, and Jeff was there, and she said, Casey, I'm really sorry I wasn't there for you when you were growing up. And that was the exact same time I was supposed to be making amends to her. That's pretty powerful. The other amends, I don't know if you remember me talking about 3/4 of my resentments. You know, we're smashed out, but there was still that quarter of resentment, and those were the people that that I had to work on, that I had to pray for. I remember those were the ones that I wrote on the rock, and I threw it in the river. I did all the things you told me to do. I wrote on a piece of paper, I stuck it into the sink, I lit it on fire, and I was still in pain. I was still hurting. None of that stuff worked. But every time it did come up, I would pray for them. And I would ask God to bless them and give them everything that I wanted. And then I would just say, I choose to forgive. I choose to forgive. So it wasn't about a feeling. It was about a choice. So when you get to your amends, you kind of know, like, if you still have something in there. Because when it's your turn to make an amends, you're like, well, they did this, 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 and this. And you start justifying. You start minimizing. You start making excuses. And my sponsor said, don't look at what they did to you. You're looking at what you did to them. And I realized that I really harmed that other person. And one of them was my ex-husband. And I didn't know what I was going to do to make things right. He wasn't allowed to talk to me from his wife, so I couldn't make a direct amends. So I began to pray for that and pray for him, and I finally decided that, well, what I could do is I could not talk crap about him anymore. When the kids are talking crap, when my family's talking crap, when everyone else is talking, I'm not going to participate, and I'm going to honor him, and my amends is going to be I'm not going to say anything bad about him. And guess what happened? I got freed up. That bitterness, that anger inside of me, I got freed up from it. See, I had been all that venting, all that complaining, all that talking, was just fueling that resentment. So I thought, you know, the ninth step was going to be about other people forgiving me, but it was really about me forgiving them. I had some financial amends, and this one hurt a little bit more. But I realized I owed $45,000 to people. And when I went to calculating everything up and paying it back, it was going to take me 10 years to pay everything back. And I thought, I'm not going to do it. I can't. There's no way I can do that. I might as well not do it at all. And I had a sponsor, one of those first sponsors, that told me, pay it back a dollar at a time. And that's what I did. And I listed my debts from smallest to largest, and just started calling people and negotiating and marking them out one at a time. And I started to get freed up. You know, I was free from active addiction. Now I had some financial freedom. One of the really, really hard debts I skipped over. I didn't want to pay back because I didn't feel like I owed it. It was from a friend that I co-signed for a loan. And I was like, I didn't get that money. I don't owe it. And the whole time I'm calling her during this time, like, you're going to pay it back. You got this bill. You know, you owe it. I call her husband, never get anything in return. Finally, Jeff, my husband, I married somebody in recovery, by the way. I forgot to tell you that. So now I have a sponsor. I have my husband. I have my husband's sponsor. I have all this accountability. He said, you signed for the loan. You need to pay it back. That girl ain't never going to pay that back. And so I ended up calling them, and I negotiated this $2,500 debt for $1,400, and I paid it, and it hurt in the process. I didn't want to do it. Then I got to my last debt, and, you know, you remember how I told you it was going to take 10 years for me to pay this off? Guess how long it took? 18 months. We can't always see it, you know? And Daisy, when she shared her story, she called it spiritual math. And it's just amazing when we do the right thing and just put one foot in front of the other, how God just kind of steps in and takes care of it, you know? So I got to my last debt, and my daughter drove with me down to the hospital to pay it. We walked in, we paid it, and we came out, and we called, you know, Jeff, and we're yelling, we're debt free, you know? And she said, it was so exciting. And that same day, guess what? That girl called me. She said she was wanting to make things right in her life, and she wanted to pay me back. I was like, what? The same day I paid. My daughter was with me, so she got to witness all this. She was like, Mom, she said, I think God wanted you to pay back the people you owed before you got paid back. And I was just like, oh my gosh, you know. And so that was a really, really cool experience to have with my daughter. And so I met up with her, gave her a hug, and got the money. And I called Jeff, and he was like, no way, you know. He was always telling me, you ain't never going to get that money. And I had some other things to clean up, you know, 4 years into my marriage. My husband, I have a great husband. When we dated, on one of our first dates, we went out to eat. And we're sitting there, and he said, what's your clean date? And I remember thinking, how rude. Like, he's really going to get this deep and personal? That's rude, you know? And so I lied, you know? And I didn't know if he had some type of clean time requirement or something, and I liked him, you know? And every time I would get up the courage, I was like, I'm going to tell him the truth. I'm going to go tell him something weird would happen, or he'd say something weird like, anything based in dishonesty will eventually crumble. He said that, and I'm like, I can never tell him the truth. Our relationship will be over, and I'm taking it to the grave, you know. And so I finally told him, and he said, that explains a lot. We're 4 years into our marriage, y'all, and that's how long it took me. And But he said that because I wouldn't pick up my time. I wouldn't get my medallion. I didn't want to go to birthday night. When we were at the convention like this and they were doing the clean time countdown, I would conveniently go to the bathroom, you know? So he thought something was wrong with me. I have a great husband. We have an awesome relationship. He mentioned it here. Also how he has a program, I have a program. We're kind of like, we have autonomy. We have the freedom to make our own decisions, but we consider each other when we make those decisions. And it's just been the most amazing thing. I know when we got together, we kept waiting and watching, like, what's going to happen? You know, who's going to do what? Is there going to be some chaos? And there just never was until we got on a committee together. And then we started arguing, and I was like, wow, we're in a real marriage now. Anyways, I enjoyed serving with him, but now we never came to an agreement, and so we finally, that was the one time in our life we had to just say, hey, we're just going to have to agree to disagree, you know. And I learned a lot about service and being a part of service, and been on some retreat committees, convention committees. Three main things I learned, or a few things I learned, were one, it's not as easy as it looks, is it? It's a lot harder than it looks. I have a new appreciation for everybody, the trusted servants, the people on the committee. I have a new appreciation after have serving. What's easy is to sit back and to judge and pick apart everything. That's what's easy. And so if you're doing that, then I want to encourage you to get on the committee. And I know that Dalton said that last night too. The second thing is, oh, I learned about humility. There's nothing like putting your heart and soul into something and somebody says, that sucked. You know, pride will say, well, I'm not going to do that again. You know, but humility says, I'm going to do it again. I'm going to keep showing up and I'm going to keep trying and I'm going to keep making mistakes. You know, in our literature said we learn, we grow and we make new mistakes. We're not just practicing new skills, but we're breaking old habits. And so the next thing I learned was, not everybody likes what I like, you know. I was on a convention committee, and there we did submission for t-shirts, and I really liked the one that I created. And I thought everybody else would, too. And so we had two. We had a tree, and we had a pinwheel with ghosted principles. And I already knew everybody was going to love the pinwheel with ghosted principles. And we got in there, and they voted for the tree. And I was like, what? And then I thought, well, there's a lot of Ada people in here. They're kind of tight. So it's not an accurate vote, you know. And besides that, there's just a few people on the committee. There's hundreds of us in NA, you know. And so I started reaching out. They already made their decision, but I started reaching out to other members. I was like, hey, do you guys like this one or this one? And they'd send me back, we like the tree. I was like, what? And everybody, and so I sent it to my family. And my sister and Stefan, they were like, the tree? And Jeff was like, hey, you gotta give that up. So, and then the next thing I learned, man, there's always gonna be somebody difficult. It doesn't matter. You can run, but you can hide. You can't hide. It doesn't matter what committee, what retreat, what group conscience, no matter where we go, there's always gonna be somebody difficult to work with. And it could have been me for some of y'all. But what I learned is that I don't need to try to change and fix them. You know, even if I'm 100% sure that they're wrong. And when I grabbed a hold of that, the need to change or fix somebody, I got more serenity in serving, you know. There was a lot more other things that I've learned. Man, that I would not have been able to learn had I not been a part of or been allowed to be a part of and given this opportunity. And I guess I say that because it could be tempting when people are coming up for positions to always pick the more experienced person. You know, things are going to go smoothly, things are going to be easier, they've done it for several years, they're good at it. But when we do that, we prevent spiritual growth in ourselves and in others. And so I'm just mentioning that because I've learned so much. Just the little bit of service I've done, I've learned so much. I've been able to sit back and see all the mistakes I made and how I really didn't put the primary purpose, make our primary purpose our purpose, and all the things that came along and how to work with others and God's will versus self-will and all the things that are really important. And so that's why I want to mention that. And if we make up our mind and we lead other people to believe that there's unity in the decision process, then we're being dishonoring to others and to Narcotics Anonymous. And I'll just leave that there. And these are things that I've done. These are things that I've been a part of. I want to talk a little bit. I just got a few more minutes for those that you guys are leaving. No. I'm just going to talk a little bit about my work and what I do for a living. But I take care of leukemia and lymphoma patients, and it's the love of my life. And it's very hard. Not only do I deal with a lot of death, but a lot of suffering. And so I see a lot of things. It's pretty painful. And I haven't really talked about it much. You know, I'm very compartmentalized. I have my work here. I have my recovery here. I have my family here. And I'm starting to learn that I can kind of come all together. And that's really the healthiest way to be. But I was just, that was my survival mode. Some of the things that I see at work are, you know, patients with, you know, tumors. Their tumors are so big in their throat, they can't breathe. We have to intubate them. They have sores from the top of their head to the bottom of their feet. They can't eat because there's so many sores in their mouth. We have to do feeding tubes. They bleed. Their platelets are low. Their eyes bleed. Their skin bleeds. They bleed out their bowels. They shed their skin. They look like they have burn from top of their head to the bottom of their feet, and their skin is all over the floor and all over the bed, and we have to sweep it up and clean it up because of their body's attacking themselves. And I'm in the outpatient. I don't want to scare anybody who's doing treatment, but I'm not an outpatient. I'm in the hospital. So I see the things that don't work, and I see the really bad things. And we help them get their, we help them reach their goals sometimes. Sometimes their goal might be to make it to their daughter's birthday next week. She's going to be 7 years old, and they just want to stay alive long enough to be there. And so we fill them full of a bunch of blood and platelets, and we pack their nose so their nose doesn't bleed, and try to get them to where they can be a part of that birthday party. Maybe they want to make it to this, their celebration of life, you know, and so that they can see all their friends and their family at their celebration of life. And sometimes they make it to their goals and sometimes they don't. And I go into work every day. We have a board that says RIP, rest in peace. And I go into work every day and I don't know whose name is going to be on that board. And every time I'm shocked, and I've been doing it for 8 years, and I'm like, no, you know. And I just want to share that with you guys because 22 months ago, my husband was diagnosed with lymphoma, which is one of the things that I treat on my floor. So it really got me. And my heart, when we got the diagnosis, my heart just dropped to my feet and everything just spinning around me. And anyways, they did biopsied and everything, and they said, hey, it's a slow growing lymphoma, and maybe, you know, he might die with it, not from it. And so we went on about our lives, and I sort of changed me from being like friend focused to kind of husband focused because I didn't know how much time I was going to have with him. Last November, not this one, but the November before, he started having some pain and twisted his back, and it just progressed, and we went on just thinking it was a back thing, and finally, I don't know, Marches or so, we went into the oncologist, and they said that one of his tumors had grown in his sacrum area, and we didn't know if that was what the pain was for, but he was having sciatica pain, and he was having trouble walking. It was horrible, and he told them that he twisted his back, and they said, well, maybe it's a back issue. You know, maybe it's not this tumor. And we were seeing a spinal doctor and going back and forth. Well, the pain just got worse and worse and worse. And this man couldn't sit. He couldn't stand. He couldn't walk. He wasn't sleeping. It was so bad. And we were trying to figure out what to do. And I was scared. And I reached out to a member of Narcotics Anonymous, a highly respected member, and said, I can't watch my husband suffer anymore. You know, we had done all the things. We had done acupuncture, medical massage, massage, ice, heat, TENS units, everything that they tell us to do in recovery, you know, because we can't do pain medication. We did everything. We bought high dollar chairs. I mean, whatever you could think of, we did, and it didn't work. And I remember saying, I cannot watch my husband suffer anymore. I have to do something until we figure out what's going on. And we had considered doing some pain medication short term, and I was really scared. And I told him, reach out to your recovery buddies. You got to tell everybody. I don't want to keep this a secret. I don't want to be alone in this. There's a lot of things that I have a lot of education about these medications. I've had a lot of experience. I've lost a lot of friends. I had a nurse friend that had surgery, broke his elbow. He died. They just found him. He didn't wake up because he had taken so much. So I was scared to death. Well, that week, he ended up in the hospital. And we found out that his cancer had spread everywhere, all over his body, to his liver, to his bones. It was everywhere. And he was sort of delirious. He could not grasp that understanding. He did not know that. So I was alone in that. You guys were my light in the darkness. You guys were my light in the darkness. You called, you texted, you sent food, you came and checked on us. I know Raphael and Jay stayed on the phone with me every day, texting me and letting me process everything that was going on with Jeff. You guys posted pictures on Facebook with you and Jeff, and that was an encouragement to me. Every time I would scroll on social media, I would see that, and I would like, we're not alone. People are praying for us and with us. And so we got out of the hospital, and in the hospital, I remember praying, God, please don't take my husband. Will you heal my husband? I know you can, but will you? And I said, God, I love you more. I love you more. You do not have to remove Jeff from my life for me to prove that to you. And some people call that, in the therapeutic community, they call it part of the grieving process. It's bargaining with God. But my sponsor taught me about unwavering faith. And she taught me about what faith was. And it's not getting the outcome that you want, but it's trusting God with the outcome and that he's going to walk with you through it no matter what it is. And I was committed to God, and I was committed to my program and to stay clean no matter what. We got out, and the treatment, Jeff's responded to treatment, by the way. It took all his pain away. His tumor shrunk. And we started the process of going and doing all the treatments, and he is in remission. So we're just praying for a length of days, and we're truly grateful for however many days God added to us. We're grateful for that, and we don't take it for granted at all. And, you know, I sort of beat myself up about the whole process and how everything went down when I'm looking at it. Like, how didn't I know? I'm an oncology nurse, and I was kind of in denial. I wanted it to be the back. And why did I let my husband go so long in pain? I just beat myself up. I had a lot of guilt and shame about it. And I sort of got some peace with my higher power about that. And I realized that, man, if we would have started all those pain medications early on and treating that pain, I don't know that we would have masked the pain and we wouldn't have made it into the hospital, and that he would even be alive and here right now. So I'm truly grateful for my experiences, my programming that led up to everything happening just as it was supposed to. And God was working things out just as he was supposed to, including, you know, that job I had gotten as an oncology nurse, because Jeff ended up on my floor. And all because I was willing to practice the principle of the program, step back and let God move, you know. And Jeff's retired now. I don't know that he would have been. We talked about it. We prayed about it. We were trying to think of the right time for him to retire, and there's never a right time. And I felt like God was saying, hey, buddy, you're on a short string. I got work for you to do. because that kind of put him into some early retirement. And I'll just end with this. 2026 is a new year, and my husband always says goals are really good. What's cool about goals is you achieve them, and if you don't, you can reset the time limit and then get there again, and then you achieve those. But one thing that I forgot how it went, but purpose is never ending. And we have a purpose today. And so I was going to share with you what my purpose is. It's my purpose to love and care for my husband and take care of him, no matter how bad it hurts him. And it's my purpose to love and care for those adult children. I talk to you about, no matter about how bad it hurts them. Right? We have to do hard things sometimes. And it's also my purpose to share my higher power with others and to pray for them if they ask. You know, and if that freaks you out, then we have a book called How and Why, and there's a second step, and you should read it. It says, when you're in your search, when you're in the search and you're looking for a higher power, you should talk to your sponsor about it. Talk to other addicts. We can ask others how they arrived at that, and that we can adopt the ideas of other people. And so I'm always open to share my higher power with anybody. And Narcotics Anonymous is really... has done so much for me. Every time I process my story, I'm just in awe about everything that I have and everything that, the way things are because of Narcotics Anonymous. So it's my privilege and purpose to carry the message of recovery unconditionally to anybody that has a desire to receive it. So, and with that, I'll let you guys go. Thanks for letting me share.